sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to Sci-Fi Show Outcast 45. Today I have an interview with Dr. Frank Tipler, who gave us such things as the anthropic principle, and he's a pretty interesting guy to talk to. I hope you enjoyed this Outcast.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Dr. Frank Tipler. So first up, can you tell me a bit about yourself, what your background is and who you are?
I am currently a professor of mathematical physics at Tulane University in New Orleans in the United States, and my undergraduate degree was from MIT, and after getting a undergraduate degree in physics from MIT, I got a PhD in physics from the University of Maryland. Then I went to do postdoc work at UC Berkeley, Oxford University, and University of Texas in Austin before coming to Tulane. Now, when I was at Austin, I was the postdoc of John Wheeler, the famous physicist who was the teacher of Richard Feynman and who himself was the postdoc of Niels Bohr. So I've had the good fortune to be taught by some very great men over the course of my career, and I'm trying to follow in their footsteps.
Fair enough. Now, you're probably, well, I first encountered you in regards to the anthropic principle. How'd you come up with that idea? And could you describe that for the listeners?
Well, I wrote a book with the man who is now a professor of astronomy at Cambridge University in England. His name is John Barrow. We wrote a book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, which came out when I had just come to Tulane University in, 1986. We had actually conceived the book when we were both postdocs at UC Berkeley in the late 70s. I in the mathematics department and John in, of course, the astronomy department. He had just gotten his PhD from Oxford and was on leave for Oxford to do research in the United States. And we were talking about various projects which we could work on together. We noticed that a famous British physicist by the name of Brandon Carter, who had coined the term the anthropic principle, had written a paper which he had never published and described all the ramifications of the principle. We thought it would be a nice thing to do to publish finally, so it would be generally available to everybody, Carter's results and extend them. So that's what became our book, the Anthropic Cosmological Principle. Now, what it involves is addressing the question of what is the relationship between mankind and the universe. That one of the things we have to realize when we're looking out in the universe, that we are actually looking at the universe from a very privileged point of view. One thing about the universe is that its average density, that is the amount of mass per unit volume, is about 10 to the minus, that's exponents, 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. Whereas here on Earth, the density is of the order of 1 gram per cubic centimeter. The atmosphere is local atmospheric pressure, about a thousandth of a gram per cubic centimeter. In other words, many, many orders of magnitude larger than the average density in the universe. So you can ask, why are we living in such a very weird place in which the density is so high? The answer is very simple, and it's obvious once you think about it, namely that only if the density is so high could intelligent beings actually exist and ask the question, why is the density here so high? So this is an example of what is called the weak anthropic principle, or as Carter said after the fact, he would have preferred to call it the selection principle. What you're trying to do is select observations from what is just seems to be a fundamental constant of nature, but is actually due to the fact that where you are in the universe, you could only get this particular answer. Another example of that is the so-called Hubble constant, which is now been observed to be about 75 kilometers per second per megaparsec. What that number does is give you an estimate of how fast the universe is now expanding. Now, in the 50s, people thought that this was an unchanging constant of nature, and that was the basis, this Hubble constant being a true constant, was the basis of what was then called the steady state theory. We now know it's false, that this so-called constant has been varying with time. Over universal time, it was much, much higher in the early universe. The initial singularity was actually infinite, and it's been now, it was slowing down for a huge length of time of universal history. Then about 5 billion years ago, it started to increase again. So the particular value which we actually see is due to our particular place in the universe. But we have to wait sufficiently long in order for the intelligent life to evolve, because in the very universe, when the Hubble constant is so very high, intelligent life cannot exist. It's simply too hot. So we had to wait till the universe got much larger and cool down before we could see the Hubble constant being the value there is. Now, this is another example of selection, what we think is due to what we think is a fundamental constant of reality is not a constant at all. We're just having to measure this at a particular type in universe time in universal history, which is consistent with our existence. We could not measure it much earlier. We won't be able to measure this particular value much later. So this is an example of the weak anthropic principle. Now, as I said, in that book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, Barrow and I developed all possible implications of this question, what is the relationship between man and the cosmos, going far beyond Carter. One of the directions at the very end of the book we decided to do is address the final anthropic principle, we called it, which was, suppose the intelligent life actually must exist for some reason in the universe, and what must the universe be like in order for the for intelligent life to continue forever? It was not even thought possible that intelligent life could exist forever until Freeman Dyson wrote a very famous paper in 1979, which made a big impression on me and John Barrow, and we devoted the last chapter of our book to that particular question. What would the universe have to be like if life is to go on forever? Now, I have devoted two subsequent books to that question. The first one came out in 1992, The Physics of Immortality, and I considered, gave arguments why if the life is to continue forever, then it actually has to exist in a closed universe. So I argued that the universe is closed, and although it's accelerating now, it will eventually start slowing down again and reach a maximum size and then recontract into a final singularity. And as we are approaching the singularity, human knowledge, or perhaps I should say our descendants' knowledge, human beings won't exist forever. We are probably a typical mammalian species, and an upper bound to the lifetime of a mammalian species is around, the average of 10 million years. We can't expect to exist forever. Most species which have existed on this planet are already become extinct. We have to expect the same is true for us, but maybe our descendants can go on forever. After all, we're descending from organisms that first rose on this planet about 3.8 billion years ago, which is a substantial fraction of the whole of universal history. So why can't our descendants go on forever? Well, I argued that they could, that I investigated the consequences of that, and I concluded that in the very far future, when technology and information processing, computing power increases without limit, vastly more powerful than what we now have, the beings in the far future would be able to bring us back into existence as computer emulations in their machines, identical to the situation we now find ourselves in. We would, I argued, be resurrected and need never die again. So what I was presenting in that first book, The Physics of Immortality, is a claim that progress goes on forever, that rationality increases, and wealth grows without limit, and everybody who has ever lived will eventually be brought back into existence, never to die again. So it was a very encouraging picture of universal history. In the far future, things are going to be much, much better than they are now. Things are going to be improved without limit, though of course we'll have setbacks. And in fact, when we die today, which looks like what most of us will now do, we'll have a second chance sometime in the far future. Now, I argued, since intelligence is going to become infinite at the very end of time, and intelligent life will know everything that there can be known at the very end of time, and because intelligent life will have to expand and engulf the entire cosmos in the very far future, it will be omnipresent in reality, I argued that the final state of the universe, which is not in the universe itself, but the final singularity, would in fact be God. So this brought me in a connection with theology, and I've been working at it ever since. In my current book, which will come out on May the 1st in the United States, The Physics of Christianity, I'm arguing that actually the singularity is triune, that is, it's a trinity. There's the initial singularity, which universe began in about 15 to 20 billion years ago. There is the final singularity at the very end of time. And from inside our universe, these look like two distinct singularities. Actually, we can see that there is another apparent third singularity in this mix, which we can see only if we look at all the universes. Remember, quantum mechanics teaches us that we do not live in a single universe. Rather, all reality consists of a multiverse of an infinite number of universes, with an infinite number of me and yous carrying out an infinite number of these conversations right at the same moment. From this multiverse point of view, you see that the initial singularity of our universe is connected to the final singularity of our universe, so there is only one individual universe out there. And I already drawn the conclusion that the final singularity has to be God, but you can draw in yet another connection with theology, because the great theologians, for example, Maimonides and St. Thomas Aquinas, writing about in the 13th century, defined God to be the uncaused first cause. Now, if you look out in physics, we know what causes are, we physicists. We find out that all causes started at the initial singularity. But the initial singularity itself, physics tells us, had no cause, so it was the uncaused first cause. In other words, using the definitions of the great theologians, the initial singularity is in fact God. So we have two connections with theology: God the final singularity, God the initial singularity, and the all-present singularity would be the third aspect of this one single cosmological singularity. That's a summary of what I've been doing over the past 25 years.
Okay, thank you. Now, when you say the singularity is God, what does that mean? Is it personal or impersonal?
Well, it's personal. It wouldn't be God, but remember, if it wasn't personal, because remember that the starting point of definition of God is he is the, we won't use the word he, which sort of precludes the argument, we'll call it it. It certainly is the uncaused first cause. Now, if you look at the five ways of Aquinas, whereby he claimed to prove the existence of God, he deduced, using Aristotelian physics, which unfortunately we know is not valid, so for that reason his proofs are invalid, he deduced the existence of an uncaused first cause, and he could not say from the proofs themselves whether it was personal or impersonal. So, it certainly appears to be impersonal, because remember, the cosmological singularity is outside of space and time altogether. It's not matter, and it's not space and time. So the question is, how on earth can we call it personal? Well, one of the things we have to use is a notion of personality, which is more general than member of the species Homo sapiens, because we want to entertain the idea that were we ever to meet extraterrestrial intelligent beings, that we could count on them as persons. Now, Alan Turing, the famous computer scientist, wrote a paper in the 1950s. He was concerned in this paper with, can a computer be said to think? Now, I'm going to change his meaning slightly, because I think his meaning can encompass the idea of, can a computer be a person? Now, certainly in science fiction, it can be. For example, I think everybody has seen the movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Terminator. Have you seen that movie?
I've I've seen all, how many of them? Oh,
three at least.
Three of them, yeah.
Okay, I'm sure your audience has too. And in that movie, Schwarzenegger, of course, is a human being, let's face it, is not a machine at all, but he does play a robot. And certainly, we doubt in the first one whether the Arnold Schwarzenegger character is a person. He is totally remorseless. But at the very end, the Arnold Schwarzenegger robot takes on the characteristics of a person. Why do we say that? Because he acts and talks like a person. Now, that was Alan Turing's great insight, that we don't care about how it actually works if it can actually talk to you. For example, right now you're interviewing me on a telephone. It's logically possible that I'm not a member of the species Homo sapiens at all. Maybe I am a robot pretending to be a human being. From your point of view, what difference does it make? Because I am responding to your questions, I am talking in a human voice, I am making human type of pauses, just like a normal human would be when he's carrying on a conversation with you. That was Alan Turing's crucial point. An entity, a computer in Alan Turing's case, we might imagine an extraterrestrial intelligent being, or let's generalize it even further to say God, counts as a person if he can talk to you and persuade you that he or it is a human being. If an alien can talk to you, if a robot can talk to you, of course it's a human being. And we've all seen movies in which the computer act like a human being. I can give huge numbers of examples. Arthur Clarke, 2001. Remember the robot Hal?
Mm-hmm.
The robot Hal carries on a conversation with the guy in the spacecraft. Now, of course, there is no change of emotion in there. It's all flat. But a real programmer would change that. That the back and forth talking would carry little inflections, little errors to make it more human rather than this entirely flat voice. That's a very temporary state of affairs in computer programming. If it had that, of course, even as it was, we never really doubted that Hal was a person. What was your reaction to Hal?
Oh, I would agree with you. Yeah, he's a boring human being.
Boring human being. But the crucial thing is not the word boring, but the word human being. Now, if you can laugh like me, I'll do a much better job of persuading you I am a human than Hal does. Because of my change in tone and I was giving a little laughter sound to my voice and so forth, everybody actually does this in normal conversation. But that's really easy to program. We just haven't bothered to do that yet. We could do it, and as our programming skills get better and better, we'll be able to do it better and better. Eventually, there'll be programs around that will persuade you, no question, that they are in fact persons. So, let's keep this in mind, and let's ask, can the cosmological singularity carry on a conversation with you? If you think about it for just a few moments, the answer is obviously yes, because what the cosmological singularity does, remember, it generates all of the laws of physics, and it adjusts the boundary conditions of the universe. So, it can have a conversation with you. Let's take a typical example of a purported conversation. Moses standing in front of the burning bush. You're familiar with that passage in Exodus?
I am.
All right. Now, Moses asks, he hears a voice in the burning bush. The bush is not consumed, but the bush is not consumed only to attract Moses' attention. He carries on a conversation with an entity he does not see. All he hears is a voice, just like all you're hearing from me is a voice. In Alan Turing's example, what he was having was a typing back and forth. He was writing in the 50s. That's all that computers could do. Right now, we would have something like HAL, which would carry on a conversation using spoken English. It's not too difficult to program that. We've already been able to do it in a limited sense. When you call in to find the airplane schedules, is the airplane coming in? You are informed not by a human being, but by a computer voice. We've all had that experience. Of course, we have no doubt that we know there's not a human being on the end of the line because this conversation is too boring. It can't have any range at all. Now, the cosmological singularity has vastly more power because it's not in space-time at all. It controls space-time. It ultimately gives rise to the laws of physics themselves. So what it can do is, for example, around the burning bush, it could cause air molecules to vibrate just like it was a human voice, and it could anticipate what Moses was going to say and give the appropriate responses. Of course, it's not carrying on a mental process like we human beings are, because the cosmological singularity is not a human being, but it can carry on a conversation with us. So, by the Turing test, it follows that the cosmological singularity is a person, but not Homo sapiens.
Okay. Now, someone else who I've interviewed, Salvador Cordova, mentioned that you've been described as a provisional atheist.
And I was at the time. But
how has that changed over the years? Yeah.
That was ages ago. Because I have been learning more physics, and my attitude has always been a devotion to physical law. And the physical laws are quantum mechanics, general relativity, and the standard model of particle physics. And as over time, I've learned more and more, and I can now, in the time I wrote the Physics of Immortality, I could not prove that the singularity existed from the laws of physics. I could not prove that the final singularity existed from the laws of physics. I can now prove those. Given the known laws of physics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, and the standard model of particle physics, it follows that the initial and final singularities have to exist, and this all-present singularity also has to exist out there. So, I am now a theist, believing in the triune God, the Trinity God. And let's see, I've heard of a religion which says God is triune, and that's Christianity. So, tentatively, I am not only a theist, believer in God, but also a Christian. Now, in this subsequent book, this book that's coming out in on May the 1st, I see how far we can justify the traditional assertions of Christianity. Not only that God is triune, after all, there is another religion out there, Hinduism, which says that God has a triune character. Hinduism says that God is Brahma and Krishna and Shiva, three aspects of a fundamental ultimate God. So maybe we should develop Hinduism rather than Christianity. So what I do in my book is look specifically at Christianity, at the central assertions of Christianity, and see if it can be justified. And I take these central assertions to be, first of all, that Jesus is God incarnate, one in being with the Father, to use the Nicene Creed's expression. Another assertion is he was born of the Virgin Mary, i.e. born in a virgin birth. And third, that he rose again after being crucified, rose again on the third day. Now, what I'm doing, remember, is I'm following my own convictions that the laws of physics never, ever change, that everything in nature, in the universe, is subject to physical law, specifically quantum mechanics, general relativity, and the standard model of particle physics. This is that these three laws are the Holy Trinity for physicists. And until an experiment shows me otherwise, I'm going to believe in those laws of physics. So it turns out that that is also the Christian tradition. The Christian tradition, in contrast to other traditions, says that God created the laws of physics in the very beginning, and that being omnipotent and omniscient, he never ever changes or sets aside the laws of physics. In particular, miracles. For example, St. Augustine, writing around 400 AD, argued this. Miracles only violate our expectation of what the laws will imply. That the ultimate physical laws were established by God in the beginning and are never changed. That he planned for these apparent violations, which are not real violations of physical law, in the beginning of time. He adjusted the laws in the beginning of time so he would never have to set them aside. Always been a tradition in Christianity that miracles do not violate physical law. The contrary view was put forward by the deist and David Hume in the 17th and 18th centuries to specifically refute Christianity. They wanted to say, aha, miracles violate physical law, but we know physical law can't be violated, therefore Christianity is false. But this was trying to disprove Christianity by definition, by using a different definition for the word miracle than were used by Orthodox Christians. So, in saying that miracles, incarnation of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, the virgin birth does not violate physical law, then the Christians are being consistent in so arguing that, in fact, if you can, physical law is never violated. If you have the ultimate physical theory, then you should be able to explain exactly how these miracles, among others, were actually carried out without a violation of physical law. And this is what I outline in my forthcoming book, or rather, the book coming out on May the 1st, The Physics of Christianity.
Now, one final question. Where's a good place to find your writings and stuff beyond the local bookstore?
The technical articles, most of them you can find on the archive, which is, this is the way everyone gets information now, on the internet, ARXIV. So Google AR or Yahoo, whatever your search engine is, ARXIV. Is Google the most popular one used in Australia, or do you have a different popular search engine?
I think it's probably the most popular one in the world at this point. I know I use it for everything.
Don't we all? So Google is now a verb. So Google Archive, and you get a search engine, and you can type in my name, Frank Tipler, or just Tipler. Sometimes it has problems with Frank. Tipler, T-I-P-L-E-R, will generate the technical papers I have written. Some of the papers I have only in the refereed physics journals. There was one in Reports and Progress in Physics that gives you the basic physics that I'm using for my Physics of Christianity. In the Physics of Immortality, I decided to put the mathematics in the book itself, which was probably a mistake because I've learned that only professional physicists will bother to look at mathematics, and they prefer to read in the refereed journals. Mistake, but nevertheless, I have to bow to their prejudices. So this time, I put the physics in refereed journals, and I put the non-technical description in the book. And, of course, the book is available on Amazon. It's not available in the British Commonwealth yet. But, as you know, you can always get books from the United States. I do know that when I want to purchase a book which is available only in the British Commonwealth, I can do it through Amazon, and they sneak it through customs and so forth, and I imagine it works in reverse just as well.
It does. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you for talking with me.
Hope everybody enjoyed that discussion with Professor Frank Tipler. I know I did. He was an interesting guy to talk to. If you got any feedback for the show, send it to thescifishow@gmail.com, and that's fire with a PH. I'll talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.